All right, Judges chapter 19, starting in verse 1. It says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. A certain Levite was sojourning in remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, who took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. And his concubine was unfaithful to him, and she went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem and was there some 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and to bring her back. And when he had with him his servant and a couple of donkeys, and she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he came with joy to meet him. And his father-in-law, the girl's father, made him stay, and he remained there with him for 3 days. So they ate and drank and spent the night there. And on the fourth day, they arose early in the morning, and he prepared to go. But the girl's father said to his son-in-law, 'Strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread, and after that you may go.' So the two of them sat and ate and drank together, and the girl's father said to the man, 'Be pleased to spend the night, and let your heart be merry.' And when the man rose up to go, his father-in-law pressed him till he spent the night there again. And on the fifth day he arose in the morning to depart, and the girl's father said, 'Strengthen your heart, and wait until the day declines.' So they ate, both of them." Verse 9, "And when the man and his concubine and his servant rose up to depart, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, 'Behold, now the day has waned toward evening. Please spend the night. Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here and let your heart be merry, and tomorrow you shall rise early in the morning for your journey and go home.'" Verse 10, "But the man would not spend the night." So let's pause there and just get our feet under us. What's going on here? Just like last week, we get a central figure in the story is a Levite. That's a person that's from one of the 12 tribes of Israel. They had a special duty given to them. Instead of getting land as an inheritance, they were given a job to do. Basically serve in the tabernacle or serve in the temple. They're also given cities in which to live scattered throughout all of Israel. Okay, this guy says he's kind of wandering about in the hills of Ephraim. He's not where he's supposed to be. That's what we need to know about this guy. On top of that, instead of serving the people in the tabernacle, he's kind of on this walkabout, and he's collecting mistresses for himself. When you see this word concubine, it's sort of a wife, but not really, not a full measure of a wife. The Old Testament has men that married wives and more wives, and they added concubines onto to the side. So it's either for childbearing or sexual favors or whatever. But it's kind of a combination of a mistress, wife, but sort of in a second class sort of a way. Now, when this woman had an affair with her against her husband, it's still considered an affair because they're married, but she's a concubine, not full rights as a wife. That's kind of the idea. But their relationship is not formal. It's not personal. It's not anything. It's just sort of this sexually charged relationship, and that's what it's for. You can see she turns against him. She has an affair, and then she returns back to her father's house. 4 months later, he comes after her. That's what it says. So he goes knocking on his father-in-law's door. His father-in-law's excited. He runs out to meet him. And then he stays for 5 days, and there's this weird back and forth. You know, he stayed for 3 days. Then he goes to leave, and the father-in-law's like, "No, no, no, don't go. Stay one more night." And he ate, and they got drunk, and he stayed. And then the next day, the same thing. Finally, the guy had enough, and then he decides it's time to move on. Well, what's happening in those interactions? What do you guys think that's all about? Why is there this thing? Is it just a Middle Eastern culture thing that's happening? In a sense, it is. The guy is showing hospitality to a guest. Okay, the father-in-law is showing hospitality to his son-in-law. In a sense, he's trying to repair the damaged relationship between his daughter and this man. He's welcoming the guy back. His daughter wronged him, and he's trying to make good by showing the guy kindness and favor. I think even more than that, he's trying to repair his family's damaged reputation. His daughter would have brought shame on the family, having committed adultery with this man. And so he's doing all these things. He's trying to make good, make things right. Just a quick side note on this. The Bible says when you get married, you leave your father and mother you join to your husband or wife and you become one flesh with them. You start a new family. You start a new life with that person. Here we see a company of three. Okay, the father-in-law is getting in the middle trying to make all this stuff. I only stop to say this. Often we see a lot of young people are too closely tied to their parents for too long. If you're single, if you're moving back home for the summer, or if you're dependent on your family in any way, no problem. There's going to come a day where you will have some additional greater separation from your family. Now, marriage is a clean cut there. It should be a cleaner cut. But even after they get married, a lot of times we see young people that are too, they allow their family, parents, father, mother, brother, sister, all the rest, control their life more than they should. I'm not saying you can't have a relationship or shouldn't have a relationship with your parents, especially if it's on good terms. It's nice to be able to go home, enjoy your family, and be around and celebrate time with them. However, if you get married, you now have a new family, and your new direction, your new goals, your new direction in life is with your new husband and your new wife, and you're starting a new life altogether. And so this redefines everything. This means the relationships with your family do get redefined. They change. I'm sure in a measure you're experiencing that as single people in college. It's harder to go home every time, or it's harder to hear your parents make suggestions about what you ought to do. And that'll continue, but your relationship is being redefined with them. Now, take that a step further. You get married. You don't need to bring your parents into all your problems. You don't need to let them control life as to how they think you ought to be. This is a clean slate. This is a new start. This is you, your husband and wife, and the Lord starting a new life together. That's a bit of a rabbit trail. I don't know if this guy was really kind of inserting himself in the middle. One thing you don't see in this interaction is the wife. She has no voice. She's not giving any feedback or input. Her father's basically trying to give her back to the man she tried to leave against, you know, any sort of desire apparently that she had. But it's these two guys just drinking, and it says making merry, which is fun. But that's basically what's happening. Finally, the man decides it's time to leave, and so they move on. It says in verse 10, he rose up and departed and arrived opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. He had with him a couple of saddled donkeys, and his concubine was with him. When they were near Jebus, the day was nearly over, and the servant said to his master, come now, let us turn aside to this city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it. And his master said to him, we will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel. We will pass on to Gibeah. And he said to his man, come and draw us near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or Ramah. So they passed on and went on their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. And they turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. And he went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. And behold, an old man coming from his work at the field at evening. The man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was sojourning in Gibeah. The men of the place were Benjaminites. I should know this. And he lifted up his eyes, and he saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, where are you going, and where do you come from? And he said to him, we are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote parts of the hill country in Ephraim, from which I come. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to the house of the Lord, but no one has taken me into his house. We have straw to feed our donkeys, bread and wine for me and for your female servant, and the young man with your servants. There is no lack of anything. And the old man said, peace be to you. I will care for all your wants. Only do not spend the night in the square. So he brought him into his house and gave the donkeys feed, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. Now let's pause there. The man went to find his wife in Bethlehem. Bethlehem's only 5 miles from Jerusalem. I don't know if you guys have a weird mental idea that Bethlehem is far off in the distance. It's only 5 miles away, and you could walk there in a couple hours. But he's passing from Bethlehem. He's passing by Jerusalem. Now at the time, Jerusalem is not part of Israel. It says it's the people of Jebus. They're the ones that inhabit the city. They're foreigners. These are the enemies of Israel. Israel's actually supposed to move in and take these people out. So it's natural enemies. So the man says he doesn't want to stay in the city with foreigners. And you can kind of understand where he's coming from. He's not sure. Maybe they're hostile. At any rate, he should probably feel safer among his own people who believe the same things about God as him, who have the same value of what's right and wrong. There should be more safety in staying with the home team, don't you think? And so he says he wants to move on. Well, this old man approaches them. He offers them a place to stay in his home, and he warns them, don't stay in the town square. Okay, we're going to see why in a minute. This story is about to make a point. The Levite's thinking was correct. The man that said, I ought to be better off with my own people, the Israelites. So he skipped past Jerusalem, and they came to Gibeah, which is people of Israel, as God's people. So there should be safety here. There should be this welcome, or at least a sense of security or safety. And we're going to see where it goes in a minute. But it's a real condemnation on the people of Israel. It's going to tell you where they're at. This is how far removed from God the people of Israel are. Verse 22, as they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, worthless fellows, surrounded the house, beating on the door. And they said to the old man, the master of the house, bring out the man who came into your house that we may know him. And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not do this vile thing. Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out now, violate them, and do with them what seems good to you. And against this man, do not do this outrageous thing. But the men would not listen to him, so the man seized his concubine and made her go out to them. And they knew her and abused her all night long until the morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go. And as the morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was until it was light. Verse 27, and her master rose up in the morning, and when he opened the doors of his house, he went out to go on his way. Behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, get up, let us be going. But there was no answer. And then he put her on the donkey, and the man rose up and went away to his home. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, and taking hold of his concubine, he divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. This is terrible. There's nothing to redeem in this story. If this is the first time you've ever heard this, nothing in here is showing a sense of like there's something behind the scenes. I just don't quite know what it is that would prove that some of these actions were okay. The men of the city are so wicked and so evil. They see a foreigner come into town. They descend on the house that he's staying in, and they want him to come outside so they can rape him. That's the idea. The men inside the house are so cowardly and selfish and evil themselves that they say, how about you have my daughter and my wife come outside and you can rape them instead? That's their response. Then the man, the Levite, when they're kind of at a standstill, he just pushes his wife out the house and they go about doing that. They abuse her all night long. And she dies as a result. He apparently didn't lose any sleep over it. Okay, the next morning he wakes up. He tries to tell her to get up and go. He realizes she's dead. He puts her on his donkey, carries her home, hacks her to pieces, her dead, lifeless body, and mails it to all of Israel. I don't know why. we'll get to that in a minute. There's nothing good about this. This is awful. This is terrible. There's nothing in here that you could sort of say like, well, you know, the guy was showing honor to his guest. You know, the old man was showing honor to the guest and he wanted to protect him and he was keeping him safe. At what cost? At what expense? Okay, there's nothing good in it. All this tells us is how far removed people were from God. Now, this should be reminding you of Genesis, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Does it sound familiar to anybody? Abraham was traveling And of all things, an angel or two angels appeared to him, and they said, God is going to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah because of their terrible wickedness. Abraham argues with the angel and says, but what if there's, you know, 50 good people in the city? Then what will you do? Will you still destroy it? And it's no. Okay, well, pardon me, but what if there are 45 good people? He numbers it down all the way to whether there's anybody good in the city at all. Will God destroy those cities and the good people be lost? And the answer is no. The judgment was on Sodom and Gomorrah for doing these exact same things I just described, and this is hundreds of years prior. The difference is that's a pagan city that didn't know God. They received no revelation of God. They received no instruction from God about how to live. And God said it's their time to be judged because he's not going to let people continue to be sexually abused and killed and all the rest any longer. So he's just going to bury those cities in the ground. So the angels go into the city. They rescue Abraham's relatives out, who apparently were the only people not participating in this. The cities are destroyed through, I'm guessing, meteor showers. That's the way I picture it. What we see here is this man walks to a city of Israel, Gibeah, and he experiences the same thing. These are people that do know God or should know God. They've received revelation from God. This is how far removed they were from God. Now, this is a extreme example, the numbness towards sin, the evil of what everybody's doing. If there's any takeaway for us, this is how evil and wicked people can be. Apart from civilization, well, not even apart from civilization, they're in civilization here, and yet they still go there. But this is how wicked and people, evil people can be, or even worse, if that's possible. But this gives us a sense of human beings at their worst, doing their worst, okay? Uncontrolled. The Levite, you know, he doesn't have any problem sleeping, it would appear. He gets up and goes on with his business. He's so numb to what happened. He doesn't care about this woman that was killed and raped and all the rest. And his conscience is just seared. There's no guilt, there's no remorse. The Bible does say that we can sin for so long and be so, you know, numb to God, that our conscience can be seared too. And maybe not into this extreme case, or maybe so, but it's possible that we sin and we continue in habits that are ungodly, and that our conscience is seared to where we no longer see that action as wrong, or that thought process is wrong, or that attitude, or that idolatry. It just builds into our life, and we just sort of decide we're going to live with it now. It's kind of like when you have a cat that has peed on the carpet quite a few times, okay? The house starts to smell. If you live there long enough, you kind of stop noticing the smell until you have a guest over, okay? And then you start feeling a little self-conscious about it. That's what sin can be. You can just lose sense of how bad it is. Or what it even is doing to you. You can sear your own conscience against this. These guys were so far out of the ballpark, I don't even know. But for us, at least know that. It's possible to be so deeply entrenched in sin that we will become numb to it. We won't even feel guilt for it, or remorse, or regret, or anything. Now, verse 30 wraps up. It says, and those who saw it said, such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak. Chapter 20, then all the people of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead, and the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. And the chiefs of all the people and all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 men on foot that drew the sword. Now, this is the 11 tribes, not Benjamin. This is the 11 tribes referred to as Israel, 400,000. Verse 3, now the people of Benjamin heard that the people of Israel had gone to Mizpah, and the people of Israel said, tell us, how did this evil thing happen? Verse 4, the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered. He said, I came to Gibeah that belongs to Benjamin, and I and my concubine to spend the night. And the leaders of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house against me by night. They meant to kill me, and they violated my concubine, and she is dead. So I took hold of my concubine, cut her to pieces, and sent her throughout all the country of the inheritance of Israel, for they have committed abomination and outrage in Israel. Behold, you people of Israel, all of you, give your advice and counsel here. And all the people arose as one man, saying, none of us will go to his tent, and none of us will return to his house. But now this is what we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. We will take 10 men of 100 throughout the tribes of Israel, 100 of 1,000, 1,000 of 10,000, to bring provisions to the people, provisions for the people, that when they come, they may repay Gibeah of Benjamin for all the outrage they have committed in Israel. So all the men of Israel gathered against the city, united as one man, and the tribes of Israel sent men throughout all the tribes of Benjamin, saying, what evil is this that has taken place among you? Now therefore, give up the men, the worthless fellows of Gibeah, that we may put them to death and purge the evil from Israel. But the Benjaminites would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the people of Israel. Then the people of Benjamin came together out of the cities to Gibeah to go to battle against the people of Israel. And the people of Benjamin mustered out of their cities on that day 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah who mustered 700 chosen men. Among all these were 700 chosen men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. The men of Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 who drew the sword. All of these were men of war. Verse 18, the people of Israel arose and went up to Bethel and inquired of God, who shall go up first for us to fight against the people of Benjamin? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up first. Okay. Now, real quick, Israel reacts to what's happened. They're outraged that the guy sent body parts across the land. They hear the Levite's story, at least the shady details that he chose to give. No personal, you know, responsibility over what happened. It wasn't the actual true version of the story. It was his cultivated version that made him out to sound like he was wronged, even though he had done quite a bit of wrong himself. Israel believes him, and they decide, here's what we need to do. We need to find those worthless men of Gibeah, the village where this all happened, and we're going to kill them. We'll wipe them out, just like God would do in Sodom and Gomorrah. And I think they're actually right in that. I think this thing that they've done, I do believe there's supposed to be a measure of punishment, of action, and follow through on it. I'm not opposed to that concept of what they're trying to do. However, they go ask the people of Benjamin to turn these guys over, and they refuse. They say, no, we're not going to do it. In fact, we're going to bring our army out as well. So the 11 tribes of Israel, 400,000 men versus the one tribe of Benjamin, 26,000, I think it said, men. And they're going to go to war because they disagree about what should happen, apparently. Or Benjamin's wanting to protect its brothers. I don't know. Now, you notice the last verse we read, the Israelites sort of asked God what should happen. They didn't ask him if they should go, they just asked him who should go. And he says Judah, okay? Judah shall go first. Maybe they asked him if they should go, but it's not recorded. So all we can find, assume is they're a little bit rushing into this, thinking they know what they're doing and that they're doing it right. And they're just asking God to confirm their plan. And he says, yeah, Judah should go first. And we'll read on, we'll find out what happens. Verse 19, then the people of Israel rose in the morning and encamped against Gibeah. And the men of Israel went out to fight against Benjamin. And the men of Israel drew up the battle line against them at Gibeah. The people of Benjamin came out of Gibeah and destroyed on that day 22,000 men of the Israelites. But the men of Israel took courage and again formed the battle line in the same place where they had formed it on the first day. And the people of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until evening. And they inquired of the Lord, shall we again draw near and fight against our brothers, the people of Benjamin? And the Lord said, go up against them. So the people of Israel came near against the people of Benjamin the second day. Benjamin went against them out to Gibeah the second day and destroyed 18,000 men of the people of Israel. All these men were men who drew the sword. Then all the people of Israel, the whole army, went up and came to Bethel and wept. They sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar and the son of Aaron, ministered before it in those days. And they were saying, shall we go out once more to battle against our brothers, the people of Benjamin, or shall we cease? And the Lord said, go up, for tomorrow I will give them into your hand. Verse 29, so Israel set men in ambush around Gibeah, and the people of Israel went up against the people of Benjamin on the third day and set themselves in array against Gibeah as at other times. And the people of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city. And as at other times, they began to strike and kill some of the people in the highways, one of which goes up to Bethel and the other to Gibeah, and in the open country about 30 men of Israel. And the people of Benjamin said, they are routed before us, as at the first. But the people of Israel said, let us flee and draw them away from the city to the highways. And all the men of Israel rose up out of their place and set themselves in array. And the men of Israel who were in ambush rushed out of their place. And there came against Gibeah 10,000 chosen men out of all Israel, and the battle was hard. But the Benjaminites did not know that disaster was close upon them. And the Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and the people of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin that day. These were all men who drew the sword. Now we're going to skip down to verse 46. Next 10 verses just reiterate this ambush plan in a different order. But continuing in verse 46, so all who fell that day in Benjamin were 25,000 men who drew the sword, all of them men of valor. But 600 men turned and fled towards the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon and remained at the rock of Rimmon 4 months. And the men of Israel turned back against the people of Benjamin and struck them with the edge of the sword, the city, men, and beasts, and all that they found. And all the towns that they found were set on fire. All right, very quickly. Day one, God says, send Judah first. Now, Benjamin is in this hill country, these mountains, and they're defending their home turf. They have the advantage. They're outnumbered 400,000 to 25,000. But on day one, God tells Israel to go, and yet Benjamin defeats them, and like 20-some thousand people die. So at the end of that day, they ask God, should we go back? And he says, yes. So day two, they send more people. Again, Benjamin, it says, routs them. That means defeats or destroys. And like 18,000 more people died from Israel, the 11 tribes. So the little guy is beating the big guy at the start. Day three, it says the people fast and mourn, and they're really upset. God, what's going on here? And he says, go one more time. Tomorrow I'll actually give you success. And that's what happens. The 400,000 people of Israel just about entirely wipe out Benjamin. They go from 26,000 down to 600 that day. Now, Benjamin's already the smallest tribe of Israel. What they do is they wipe out all the men except for 600. Then after that, they go to all the cities and towns in Benjamin. They kill all the women and the children, and they burn the cities to the ground. So Benjamin is on the verge of extinction here. 600 people hiding away in the wilderness. That's who's left at the end of all this. Okay. Now, why was God telling the people of Israel, yeah, you should go up and fight, and then they lost? Does that mean that God didn't follow through on what he was saying? Does it mean that God somehow was lying to them or misguiding them? I don't think so. Honestly, everybody's at fault here. It's not as if just the tribe of Benjamin, the smaller group, they probably could have corrected earlier on in the process. But I think God's using this to pronounce some sort of punishment on just about everybody involved. So the first 2 days, he lets the people of Israel from the 11 tribes, he lets them endure some pain and some trouble and some hardship. Finally, they get to the point of where they're exasperated. They cry out to God. They pray. They fast. They seek God. And he says, okay, now I'll give them into your hands. I don't know if it's because they did those things, or if this was just the nature of what was happening, enough is enough. I don't think they earned any right or favor from God, because what they do is get carried away and wipe out Benjamin almost to the brink of extinction. They win the battle, and then they just exterminate him just about altogether. Now, what's going to be really weird is as we start chapter 21 here, they're going to feel bad about it. They said, yeah, let's do this, and then they did it, and they said, oh no, what have we done? Which is actually a pretty common pattern for sin. I want to do this, then you do it, and then you say, oh my gosh, what have I done? Okay. They're going to feel remorse and guilt over what happened, and then they're going to get into this really, really silly planning phase of how do we make it right? Okay, it just gets weirder from here. If you're not already feeling the weirdness of what's happening here, it's going to get even more so. Chapter 21. It says, now, the men of Israel had sworn at Mizpah, no one of us shall give his daughter in marriage to Benjamin. And the people came to Bethel and sat there till evening before God, and they lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. And they said, O Lord, O God of Israel, why has this happened to Israel, that today there should be only one tribe of Israel lacking in Israel? I botched that. The next day, the people arose early and built there an altar and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings, and not sin offerings, if you'll make a note. And the people of Israel said, which of all the tribes of Israel did not come up in the assembly to the Lord? For they have taken a great oath concerning him who did not come up to the Lord, to Mizpah, saying, he shall surely be put to death. So when they congregated to make their plan of what to do with these worthless fellows from Gibeah in Benjamin, they say, anybody who doesn't show up here today with us, we're going to kill them too. Verse 6, and the people of Israel had compassion for Benjamin, their brother, and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel this day. What shall we do for wives for those who are left? Since we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them any of our daughters for wives. So Israel wants to make this right. They seem to be aware that there's only 600 men and men only left in Benjamin. And they start to make this plan, finding new wives for these guys. Only they've promised not to give their women, their daughters, in marriage to these guys. And so they say, well, what do we do? We can't give our daughters, so what do we do? Now, the plans that they come up with are some of the most obvious evidence here that the people are doing just whatever they want, okay? They're not being led, not following the Lord. They're just desperately grasping for direction. They're clinging to decisions they've already made, trying to justify them and make them work out in the end. Their logic is going to go like this, and we'll read it. I'll tell you about it first, then we'll read it. Their logic is going to be like this. We can't give any of our women to these 600 men because we have made a vow that we wouldn't do that. Okay. Basically, they've already made a bad decision and we're stuck holding to it. So let's go kill even more people from other groups in Israel, and we'll find wives out of them and give those wives to the 600 men. But what's going to happen is when they do that, they only find 400 wives. So they still need to find more wives. So they have a part B of their plan, which is going to be, okay, when we're 200 wives short, let's just tell the remaining men to hide in the bushes. And when women pass by, you can just snatch them, steal them, and they can become your wives. That way, when those men's fathers complain about my daughter got taken, we can explain to them, you know what? You did not violate your oath of giving your daughters, and so you're fine. It's okay. This is their logic. Okay, let me read this out just so we can read the scripture on this. But they're making this house of cards. They're building things based on decisions they've made, rules they've made for themselves, priorities, and all the rest. And then they're stuck operating within that in all these ungodly ways because they don't want to lose, I'd say credibility, but they don't want to lose reputation. They don't want to look weak. They want to look like they've broken a vow, which they think is worse than sinning. And we talked about vows earlier in the semester. Certainly, they've made a number of them here that have kind of locked them into this place where they need to repent of the vows. They need to pull back from these promises that they've made and start doing the right thing, not continue deeper and deeper, further and further, stuck in what they've already committed themselves to. So let's read it out here, starting in verse 8. And they said, what one is there of the tribes of Israel that did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah? And behold, no one had come from the camp of Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. Now, it's just a small clan within one of the tribes of Israel. Not an entire tribe, but a clan. For when the people had mustered, behold, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there. So the congregation sent 12,000 of their bravest men there, commanded them, go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, also the women and the little ones. This is what you shall do. Every male and every woman that has lain with a male, you shall devote to destruction. They found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with him, and they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. Then the whole congregation sent word to the people of Benjamin who were at the Rock of Rimmon and proclaimed peace to them. And Benjamin returned at that time, and they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead, but there were not enough for them. And the people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach on the tribes of Israel. Then the elders of the congregation said, what shall we do for the wives for those who are left, since the women are destroyed out of Benjamin? And they said, there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe not be blotted out from Israel. Yet we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the people of Israel had sworn, cursed be he who gives a wife to Benjamin. So they said, behold, there is a yearly feast of the Lord at Shiloh, which is in the north of Bethel, on the east of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebanon. And they commanded the people of Benjamin, saying, go and lie in ambush in the vineyards and watch. If the daughters of Shiloh come out to dance in the dances, then come out of the vineyards and snatch each man his wife from the daughters of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin. And when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us, we will say to them, grant them graciously to us, because we did not take for each man of them his wife in battle, neither did you give them to them, else you would now be guilty. And the people of Benjamin did so and took their wives according to their number from the dancers whom they carried off. Then they went and returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the towns and lived in them. And the people of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. And they went out from there, every man to his inheritance. Verse 25, in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Okay. I mean, what more can you say? You know, we've covered this book where we see people drifting further and further away from God. That's the natural tendency of mankind. God is the creator of all things. The earth, the universe, everything in the earth, all life on earth, including human beings, men and women. The people here, the stories we've read, they just slowly drifted away from God. Sometimes it's a willful decision. We would prefer not God. We just want something else. Sometimes you can just tell it's a lazy drift that happened. They stopped paying attention to God, and they allowed themselves to drift. There's separation from God, distance from God. They were in the promised land. They were at least physically mostly where they were supposed to be. The drift wasn't in location. It was in hearts. It was in spirit. It was in will. And so what we see in them is there's a form of religion in their life. Remember, they still have the tabernacle. They can worship there. They can still be doing God things. They prayed. They asked God for help. But really, they were just deciding all along, we're going to follow these rules and not these. You know, God's not going to control our actual living. We're going to custom design our religion based on the things we like about God, the things that are convenient to us, and so on. So they maintain full control of their lives. Now, what I want to end with here is there's a lot for us to learn in this about following Jesus. It's not as if, you know, what we're seeing in these stories, sure, the external details might be different than they are for us today. We're not going to see this, you know, at least where we are in the world, not likely to see a genocide of people, not likely to see civilization crumble into these horrible situations of rape and all the rest. These things do happen, mind you. I'm just saying not in this totally depraved way. But we see this heart. We can almost hold it up as a mirror and say, you know, when it comes to following Jesus, we have common things that we can see in these other people. There's warnings for us in this. There's lessons we can learn and say, okay, I can at least understand how they get there. And maybe just by knowing that, that can hold us back or help us not go that far. Help us stop from actually going off the deep end. Common way that we see people try and follow Jesus is not giving their whole selves to him. You just pick and choose what is enough for you. Okay, this is going to church and yet maintaining a worldly lifestyle on the rest of the week. Partying, getting drunk, participating in basically the things of the world. Or reading the Bible but continuing to look at ungodly things on the internet. Engaging in worldly habits that are destroying your faith the bulk of the time, but that little bit of scripture reading makes you feel better in the morning. This is dabbling in God, is what we'd say. Or else you're making changes to become more Christian in your behavior, but not learning from Jesus, not letting him change your inward attitudes, your desires, the way you understand the world. You're trying to force the external actions so that you can at least appear to be more Christian. And you're not letting them change you from the inside out. You're putting the effort in the wrong externals. All these things we see in the people of Israel throughout the book of Judges, okay? And they were rescued by these big sweeping efforts again and again and again until finally they just weren't rescued. After a while, God let them just continue drifting. God has amazing patience. I think God continuously reaches into our lives to prompt and stir us up. But I'm saying over a long enough period of time, that voice from God or those promptings from God, they might grow less and less, and they might grow quieter and quieter. I think God's patience is amazing, but he's also patient as a loving father that wants to do what's best for his people. And so to always have to prop us up, always have to, you know, slap us on the back to wake us up. After a while, he's going to say, you know, it'd be better if you learned how to stay awake on your own. And we can see that in the book of Judges here. Let me read this in closing, and then we'll pray and we'll call it a semester. It says, to follow Jesus is to give up control decisively and wholeheartedly. To stop short of that will lead to a life similar to what we've seen in the book of Judges. Outward proximity to God, but a life spent guessing at what God might want and completely overriding what God wants for what we want. Book of Judges teaches us that we must surrender our hearts to God's heart, our will to God's will, and our lives to God's life for us. We must follow Jesus and learn from him. If we maintain control of our lives, we will never experience the life that God would like to give us. We may have control, but we will never have peace. We may have self-satisfaction, but we will not know joy. We may get exactly what we've always wanted, only to find out that it isn't enough. Following Jesus is the only way to know life as it's meant to be, walking daily with God in all our pursuits, tasks, obstacles, and decisions.